You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to have with me once again Kevin Duffy of Baring Asset Management. The Baring Asset Management Fund has made a name for itself during the last major downturn, 2008-2009. During that financial crisis, it positioned itself on the short side of the market, and it also, I believe, owned some gold and gold shares during that time. And if memory serves me correctly, the fund actually posted a triple-digit gain for at least one of those years. It did extremely well. Almost everybody else was basically losing half or worse of their portfolios. So it's with that in mind, I want to say thanks for joining me today, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Jay, and I want to wish you a happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much. It is always good to have another year, and sometimes, though, you wish the hourglass weren't winding down so fast, but it is what it is, and we want to make the most of it while we have life. So, and having you on the show is a part of making the most of it. So, again, thanks. You know, Kevin, you were recently a guest speaker at Jim Grant's Spring 2017 conference, and since many, if not most, of the listeners to this show would find that conference beyond their economic reach, I'm hoping that you can perhaps share some of the insights that you shared with that august group. And from the notes that you sent me, I believe you may have started out your speech by saying something like, I don't see Michael Lewis in this audience, but that's a shame because I believe that what we're going to see now is the bigger short. You know, Kevin, we're in something like into the eighth or ninth year of a bull market, and both bond markets, I mean, we have a major bond market, goes back for decades, but in terms of bonds and the equity market, I'm thinking of a major equity market bull since the last downturn. If anything, people now feel like this is an indestructible bull market. Why are you thinking that might not be the case?
Well, when Jim introduced me, I started out with the actually an anecdote that he told back in the late 1970s, standing in line to buy Krugerrands. And, of course, this was a mistake, and the lesson was you never stand in line to buy an asset. The bargains are always where there are no lines. So there are definitely, that pretty much describes the bear camp today, and short selling is even worse. The only lines for short selling are at the exit door.
Yeah.
So what I did was I started with the idea of, now keep in mind this audience was very sophisticated in terms of their investment IQ, but I had a little bit of a learning curve to go up in terms of Austrian economics. So I wanted to start with sort of the, you know, canned bear case, the surface level stuff, and then go into something deeper. So I started out with an example of the near extinction of bear funds, where we've seen over the last 6 years, bear funds have gone down, assets have gone down 20%, even though ETF assets have tripled. And then we got into the length. Just some examples of this bull market is very long in the tooth, as you mentioned. It's 8 years long, one of the longest on record, even though the recovery has been one of the most anemic since World War II, and made several cases. The valuations today are very stretched. And I showed a graph of the three different bubbles. We had the tech bubble and the credit bubble and now the stimulus bubble. And each one being very different. So the tech bubble, for example, was very narrow. And if you look at these, and you could look at price to sales, median price to sales is higher today than it was in 2000. I showed a graph of the total market capitalization of the Wilshire 5000 to GDP, and you can see these different peaks. And But the tech bubble was very narrow. It was a lot of money just went into tech, and you actually had an anti-bubble in the old economy stocks. The credit bubble was a little bit broader, but it was still really focused on housing and the credit sector. And this bubble is much, much broader. So that's one of the differences that we're seeing today. Sentiment was another part of the bear case. We've got extreme sentiment. The Investors Intelligence poll had been over 60% for, I think, 6 weeks in a row. Levered, and we could go on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
I could probably list eight different sentiment indicators, and they're all at extremes. Leverage, tremendous amount of leverage in the system. Margin debt is the most recent reading was $513 billion, which is a record. It's funny, the bulls like to. There's always rationalizations that you see at the top
mm-hmm.
of these bubbles, and
yes.
so the bulls have said a couple of the rationalizations that there is pessimism. People are pessimistic. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And the other is that there's cash on the sidelines. And so I showed a graph of the equity fund cash levels at 3%. They're actually.
Mm-hmm.
The latest reading was 3.1%. But this is the lowest since, I believe, 1972, before that 72-74 bear market, which was in inflation-adjusted terms, it was the worst since 1929 to 1932.
Right.
So, these are kind of the surface-level reasons for the bear case that I got into.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm looking at your chart there that shows the three bubbles, and the credit bubble was higher than was the tech bubble, and now we have a stimulus bubble that is far greater than everything else. You mentioned the credit bubble being broader. The tech bubble was mostly in that sector. It seems as though not only are these bubbles getting greater, but also broader. Is that a fair... is that a fair assessment? I mean, certainly we have you're calling this the stimulus bubble, which is affecting everything in the economy more or less. I mean, obviously, asset prices have benefited far more than a lot of other prices, but wages, for example. But is your case then for this being the bigger short, the fact that there's even greater distortions caused by this massive monetary stimulus now? Is that why you think we may be in for an even bigger decline now than we were in 2008-2009?
Right. So if we go through these bubbles, this bubble is broader, and you had mentioned it earlier that we've had a 35-year bull market in bonds, and that appears to have peaked last July when $13 trillion in bonds were in had negative yields,
mm-hmm.
So we've had this series of bubbles. And the way I look at it is, like, let's start with the tech bubble. The tech
mm-hmm.
bubble had, in terms of debt buildups, all these bubbles have had an expansion of the Fed balance sheets, but they've had debt buildups along the way. So the first one, you had about $1 trillion increase in telecom debt. That's where the malinvestment took place. The second one, the housing and credit bubble, you had about a $5 trillion increase in mortgage debt. This bubble, it's really been at the sovereign debt level.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mortgage debt, since the peak in 2008, has actually gone down a little bit. It's gone down, about $400 billion.
Mm-hmm.
But we've more than made up for that in terms of consumer debt, which has gone up about $1.6 trillion.
Mm.
But the big gains this time have been in sovereign debt. So in this country, about $10 trillion in new sovereign debt. And then you look at places like China where they've had, I believe, about a $20 trillion or $25 trillion increase in debt. So this is where... every cycle, it's the debt buildups are kind of going parabolic, and then I think if we look at the economically what's going on, the foundation, each time the foundation, the economic foundation is getting eroded more and more. That's the way I look at it.
Mm-hmm. So it really boils down ultimately to what the economy is doing, Kevin, and certainly there seems to have been a disconnect, a major disconnect, since 2008, 2009, with the owners of assets getting richer and richer, and the middle class, I would say the people that produce things that are used and so forth, are not faring very well. Do you think this will have an impact ultimately on the stock market, or can the Federal Reserve continue to pump money into the system indefinitely, or what would cause it to break down? I mean, obviously, as David Stockman says, whenever the market heads down by any degree at all, it throws a hissy fit, he calls it, and the Fed starts to stimulate, or the language coming out of Janet Yellen will suddenly become dovish. So how long can this go down, and what on earth could cause it to change?
Well, that's a question that we could spend hours talking about. And I think part of this gets into basic economics. I mean, the immediate answer is that knowing how long this can go on is next to impossible. Mm-hmm. But it's already gone on far longer than it should have gone on, and far, far longer than I think any of us would have imagined. What I tried to get into in this talk, and it was a brief talk, so it's very difficult to get into the Austrian theory of the business cycle, but I tried to explain how this works, how a normal interest cycle works, where you have basically delayed gratification. You have the idea of not consuming everything. I mean, almost going back to the desert island and Robinson Crusoe. Well, mm-hmm. How does he initially? He's just trying to survive. He's just trying to scrounge around to find enough food to survive. But at some point, he's got to start to save some coconuts, and he's got to devote other resources, namely his time, to building tools. So, it starts, this whole process starts with saving, deferring consumption in order to save, invest in projects and to have greater consumption in projects and tools and have greater consumption in the future. And the interest rate is very important to coordinate mm-hmm. this preference, this time preference in terms of do I want to have it now or would I rather have more later. So if you're willing to lower your time preference, you're going to have higher savings. That will bring interest rates down. If people have to have it now, they have a high time preference, you're going to have high interest rates. That's the way the free market works.
Mm-hmm.
Interfere with that, and through fractional reserves and through fiat money and central banking, and you have an artificially price of credit, and this is where the trouble starts. So if you have artificially low interest rates, then you're sending conflicting signals to both the producers and the consumers. To the producers, go and take on these long-term projects with lower and lower returns since mm-hmm. interest rates are low. To the consumer, hey, keep spending. You don't need to set aside savings. So you have a low savings rate coinciding with low interest rates and projects being taken on. The problem is that resources are now being consumed at both ends, both by the consumer and by the producer. So mm-hmm. the producer is, they're taking on these projects and assuming that the resources are there. Well, the resources at some point, they realize that they're not there. And, that is, summing up very briefly, the Austrian theory of the business cycle, and it explains why it can't work,
right.
That this will eventually, you'll run out of resources, and you won't be able to complete these projects, and you will have a bust.
Mm-hmm.
Putting this off only makes it worse.
So we've seen this happen. We've had the tech bubble. We've had the credit bubble. And you know, the credit bubble worse than the tech bubble. As long as you have a fiat money system, one that in which you can stimulate, it just seems like it can go on. And as you say, it's impossible to know when it's going to stop. But what we do know, what you're arguing, I think, is that ultimately the system collapses itself. I'm looking at a debt chart, total debt to GDP, and we're seeing almost an exponential growth in the total debt, and yet GDP, even if you take the government's numbers to be truthful and accurate, is growing at most in a very slow, linear fashion. So at some point, Kevin, the system breaks down, it becomes insolvent, it's not just only illiquid, but insolvency, and then what the only answer they've come up with so far is to print even more money. So how does this get resolved? I mean, I'm seeing an increasingly insolvent system with debt growing much more rapidly than income to service that debt. You would think that ultimately you should have some sort of an implosion like we had in 2008, 2009. But then won't they just come back and start printing more money and telling you you have to use that money?
They will. And you know, Jay, the honest answer is I'm not sure how all this gets resolved. You know, what I'm concerned about is how do I navigate through all this and how do I try to protect myself? And you know, one of the things that we've seen with these bubbles is that they can't go on forever.
Yeah.
They never go on forever. I mean, by postponing the day of reckoning, you're making it worse. You can't repeal economic law, so we have that on our side. And we also notice that there are always cracks that appear, and the cracks, as long as you paper over these cracks, they just get wider and wider.
Yeah.
And we've seen this first with the commodity bubble that we saw in 2011. Mm-hmm. We've seen some incredible busts. We've seen billionaires in Brazil go bankrupt. So it's not like the Austrian theory of the business cycle that this has been repealed.
Right.
It hasn't, okay? It's already been playing out. And this is a process. You're already seeing these cracks now appear in the U.S. consumer. And even though the high-end consumer has done well because stocks and bonds, the paper assets are in nosebleed territory, but you're seeing the middle-class consumer really get hurt, and not only that, a lot of these retailers and consumer-related companies, they're having to compete with technology, with e-commerce.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you look at the new low list. I think it's expanding right now, and it's just littered with Fossil and Mall REITs and Under Armour. Finish Line just reported same store sales down, and Kohl's. I mean, just across the board, you're seeing, and I think this is a sign that something is really wrong with this picture right now, even though the stock market is near all-time highs. I think we're seeing these cracks, and the cracks will just keep getting wider and wider, and at some point you'll have this sort of a Wile E. Coyote moment, and it'll be a long way down.
So the question now, with about 2 minutes left, Kevin, is how do we prepare for that? What is the Baring Fund doing now to prepare for this day? You're short the market. Talk to us a little bit. Maybe you own some gold. What are you doing?
Well, we are hedging. We're trying to do almost the impossible, which is hedge against three risks. One is front and center, the business and economic risk, and we're doing that by short selling. The second is a growing risk at the sovereign level, and we're doing that by shorting especially these ultra-low interest rate government bonds like German bunds and Italian 10-year bonds and Japanese government bonds. And we can do that with, I think, very, very compelling risk-reward. And then finally, currency risk. And I think that is probably the last act in this play, and we're doing that mainly through gold and also with gold stocks. But right now, we feel that the most important, the clear and present danger is the economic risk. We think a bust is coming. It's already started in the consumer area, and I mean, we're shorting the auto finance mm-hmm. area, mm-hmm. for example. I mean, you can look at, you know, look at charts of like an Auto Nation, the stock market since the election is up about almost 10%, the S&P 500,
right.
And it's been led by financials almost double that, but you've got AutoNation is only up about 5%, and even a Simon Property Group is actually down 6.5%, and as I said, a lot of these consumer names are starting to make new lows, so there's a real dichotomy going on right now, and I think investors should pay attention to that.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. Just one more thing. Could you tell our listeners how they might learn more about your fund and what is the threshold? I know it's not for, I mean, it is really for accredited investors, obviously, people with some means. But if there's some people listening to this show that might have the ability to invest in your fund, how can they go about doing that?
Okay, well, we have a website, and it's Baring Asset, Baring as in ball bearing, or bear, as in grizzly bear, and baringasset.com. And the site is really designed for, there's a lot of educational material on there.
Good.
And then we have actually two funds. We have a very aggressive insurance policy against these three risks, which is the Baring Fund, and the minimum is $250,000. And then we have a more conservative version of that, which is called the Baring Core Fund, and the minimum is $500,000.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Kevin, for being with us, and I hope we can catch up with you again sometime in the not-too-distant future. Well, folks, that is all the time we have for this week. Next week, my guest is going to be former Federal Reserve economist Daniela DiMartino Booth. She's going to talk about her book, Fed Up, and she'll explain why the Federal Reserve is bad for America. And I have an idea, at least, that some of her ideas may coincide with what we just heard from Kevin, so I hope that you'll join me next week. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Dynacert is a global leader in carbon emission reduction technologies. Created for use in diesel engines, the hydrogen unit has been proven to reduce carbon emissions by up to 40%, increase torque, improve engine oil quality, and provide up to 19% in fuel savings. Our leading-edge technology is designed for tractor trailers, rail, marine, and newly developed for diesel engine cars. Reducing the amount of greenhouse gases provides benefits to the environment, to communities and businesses, and to our shareholders.
Golden Predator Mining Corp., a well-financed gold exploration company operating in Canada's Yukon. Focused on advancing its Three Aces project, a high-grade gold project located in the southeast Yukon with gold and quartz outcrops at surface. Ongoing work includes trenching, roadwork, drilling, and bulk sampling. Golden Predator also holds the past-producing Brewery Creek project located near Dawson City, Yukon. Golden Predator, a company working closely with Yukon First Nations. Golden Predator trades on the Canadian Venture Market as GPY, and in the U.S. OTC market as NTGSF.
Chilean Metals is a Canadian junior exploration company focusing on high-potential copper, gold prospects in Chile and Canada. Chilean Metals' Zulima property is a Candelaria-like prospect, one of the largest mines in the world. The company has begun its drill program in Chile on its Zulima property and should be completed by the end of February. We also own a 3% royalty on future production on Teck Resources' Copaquiri property, potentially worth millions of dollars annually. This is the time to invest in Chilean Metals, a discovery story with a hedge. Traded TSX Venture under symbol CMX.
Arvista Gold's only asset is the Douay Gold Project, which is located in northern Quebec. The Douay Project currently hosts an NI 43101 resource of approximately 3 million ounces of gold and is considered to be the largest undeveloped and independent gold project in Quebec. Arvista has significant upside potential to further grow its resources and is currently undergoing an extensive 2017 drill campaign. Arvista Gold trades on the TSXV under the symbol AVA and on the OTCQB under the symbol symbol ARVSF. For more information on Arvista, please visit arvistagold.com.
Tri-Metals Mining is a growth-focused mineral exploration company exploring and developing its near-surface Gold Springs gold-silver project in mining-friendly Nevada and Utah. Tri-Metals has only drilled less than 10% of the gold targets at Gold Springs, and it already has a gold resource with a robust preliminary economic assessment. Tri-Metals believes that with further drilling, there is a significant potential to discover 3 to 5 million ounces of gold at Gold Springs. Tri-Metals shares are listed on the OTCQX and the TSX under symbols TMIAF and TMI respectively, and its website is trimetalsmining.com.